Chapter 4. The Yankees stayed where they were, and so did the Confederates. Less than 50 yards separated them in some places. Soldiers from both sides called insults back and forth to each other. They were so close, they could have chucked rocks into the other's trenches. Yet despite their proximity, the uneasy lull in the battle continued. Night fell with only scattered shots here and there. That continued the next day, and for several days after that. The bloody assault on Kennesaw Mountain had exhausted the Union Army, and the Confederates, short on supplies as they were not in much better shape. Both sides were content to sit and wait and rest from their labors. The stink of the rotting corpses between the lines could not be ignored forever, though. Corey was not surprised when the orders came down the line. A general truce had been called, and a strict ceasefire was to be observed while the Federals retrieved their dead. Those among the Confederates who wished to go out and help were given leave to do so. When Abner heard that, he set his rifle aside. "I reckon I'll go lend a hand," he said. Corey stared at him. "You're going to help the Yankees?" "The sooner they get those poor boys buried, the sooner the air'll improve hereabouts." The Tennessean shook his head. "Besides, it ain't fitting just to leave them out there. The fellow who's passed on deserves a proper burial, even a damn Yank." Corey couldn't argue with that, and he felt a little ashamed of his initial reaction. His mother had taught him better than to be so unfeeling, so unforgiving to others. As that thought went through his head, he uttered a grim chuckle at the memories it brought back. Abigail Brannan had never been the soul of forgiveness herself, yet he knew that she would want him to help at a time like this. Abner was already clamoring over the breastworks. "Hold on," Corey said, putting his rifle down next to his friend's. "I'll come with you." As he pulled himself to the top of the log barricade, he looked along the line and saw dozens of other Confederates climbing over similar breastworks and emerging from trenches. They walked out into the killing ground, gave curt nods to their blue-clad enemies, and bent to help the Yankees pick up the corpses. Corey and Abner walked toward a group of Union soldiers. The men glared at them suspiciously, but then Abner nodded to them. "How do, boys? This is a mighty sad job, ain't it?" "You're a fine one to talk," one of the Yankees said. He waved a hand at the scores of sprawled bodies, carpeting the ground. "You rebels are the ones who killed these poor boys." "A fellow don't always like the chores he's got to do, like gathering up these gents and giving them as close to a proper send-off as you can manage with the way things are. We'd like to help, but if you don't want us to, we'll turn around and go back up the hill, no hard feelings." "There's plenty of hard feelings yet." One of the other Yankees put a hand on the speaker's arm. "Take it easy, Robert. It's a truce, remember?" He gave Corey and Abner a solemn smile and went on. "We'd be glad for you fellas to give us a hand. Where are you from?"
"Tennessee," Abner said, as he bent to grasp the legs of a dead man, and the Yankee took the corpse's shoulders. "How about you?"
"Illinois." Together, they lifted the body and started carrying him toward the Federal lines. "I'm from Virginia," Corey said to the Yankee who had been angry. "Where are you from?" The man glared at him for a second, then gave a grunt of resignation.
"Michigan," he said. "Get his arms."
They lifted one of the corpses. Corey's skin crawled a little at the feeling of loose, dead flesh in his hands. The sun had done its work well. The smell out here was unbelievably terrible. Ants and maggots already infested the raw wounds. This was as close to hell as Corey ever wanted to get. To keep his mind off it, he breathed shallowly through his mouth. "My name's Corey Brannan."
"Robert Sloan."
"I'd say I'm pleased to meet you, Robert, but, under the circumstances..."
"Yeah, I know what you mean."
They reached the shallow trenches that had been scooped out of the earth by the Federals as they retreated from the attack several days earlier. Placing the corpse gently on the ground so that a burial detail could pick it up later, the two men started back, out to get another one. Sloan asked,
"What do you do back there in Virginia?"
"I haven't lived there for several years,"
but when I did, I was a farmer. My family has a place close to Culpeper. At least they did. I don't know what's going on up there now. Neither do I. There have been a lot of battles. Sloane broke off his words with a shake of his head. I work in a mill. Worked in a mill, I should say, before this damn war came. Are you going to go back to that when the war's over? Probably. The Yankee gave a harsh, bleak laugh. If I live through it. I hope you do, Corey said, and he was surprised to realize that he meant it. The two of them carried several bodies back to the Union lines in silence. Then Sloane asked, What about you? What are you going to do when it's over? Go back to that farm in Virginia? No. The answer came without hesitation. Oh, I'll go back to see my family. But I won't stay. I worked on a riverboat for a while, and I thought at the time I might like to keep on with that, but it didn't work out. His mind went back for a moment to that awful winter day in February, 2 years earlier, when the Missouri Zephyr had exploded in the Tennessee River in front of Fort Henry, its boilers bursting and taking the boat to the bottom of the river. That terrible blast had killed the riverboat's pilot, Ike Judson, who had been Corey's friend, and everyone else on board. Only Corey and the boat's captain, Ezekiel Farrell, had escaped, and the captain had never been the same after that. Farrell had met his death at Fort Donelson, but not before Corey had promised him that he would look after Lucille. He hadn't done such a good job of that, Corey thought bitterly. There had been long, painful separations between him and Lucille, although eventually they had been married during the siege of Vicksburg. Then had come the threat of Jason Gill, the abolitionist and Yankee agent who was more than a little mad with hatred of Corey. Lucille had to go one way, while Corey went the other. And again they were apart, with no way of knowing when, or if, they would ever be reunited again. So saying that his ambition to someday be a riverboat pilot hadn't worked out was an understatement. You look like you're a million miles away, Brennan, the Yankee said. Corey shook his head. Sorry. Bad memories. I know what you mean. This damn war's got plenty of them, and more coming. I'll be going to Texas after the war, Corey went on, for some reason unwilling to let the conversation die. I once knew a fella from there. They said that the best land in the world was along a river called the Brazos. I thought I might claim some of it and settle there. With Lucille, he added to himself, Texas was where he would find her and her Aunt Mildred, assuming they were still alive and safe. I hope you do, Sloane said. His earlier anger seemed to have dissipated. The grim task in which he and Corey were engaged must have drained it away. Corey knew that after talking to him for a while, Sloane found it difficult to hate a man just because of the color of the uniform he wore. He wished the politicians in Washington and Richmond had felt the same way. Seeing that he was not going to be able to dislodge the Confederates from Kennesaw Mountain without destroying his own army in the process, Sherman did what he had done since the beginning of this campaign. He tried to go around the enemy, moving to the south. All the way south, bringing the Union Army ever closer to Atlanta, even though the Federals were approaching at a tangent. Johnston's reaction also was the same as always. He withdrew the army from Kennesaw Mountain, didn't even pause in Marietta, and pulled back all the way to the town of Smyrna, where the Confederates once again settled into a line atop a ridge. Sherman had learned his lesson by now. Leaving only a small force in front of the Confederates to occupy them, he swung the rest of the army to the south and west once more. The grim dance continued with Johnston's moving all the way back to the Chattahoochee River, a scant 5 miles north of Atlanta. Sherman expected Johnston to retreat all the way across the Chattahoochee, figuring his opponent for too canny a commander to fight a battle with a river at his back. Over the past few weeks, however, slaves had been preparing especially sturdy fortifications along the north bank of the Chattahoochee. This line of thick redoubts and earthworks protected a railroad trestle and several pontoon bridges, so the Confederates could withdraw across the river in a hurry if they were forced to do so.